deadly iron blades that could slip into her hands with the flick of her wrists, and I was always afraid she might make a mistake, pat me on the cheek, and end up decapitating me. At least she didn't try to pick us up by the scruffs of our necks, or give us a bath.
"What happened?" she asked. "Everyone is safe."
Sadie took a shaky breath.
"Well..."
We told her about the destruction of the Texas gnome. Bost growled deep in her throat. Her hair poofed out, but the braid held it down so her scalp looked like a heated pan of Jiffy Pop popcorn.
"I should have been there," she said. "I could have helped."
"You couldn't," I said. "The museum was too well protected. Gods are almost never able to enter magicians' territory in their physical forms. Magicians have spent millennia developing enchanted wards to keep them out. We'd had enough trouble reworking the wards on Brooklyn House to give Bost access without opening ourselves up to attacks by less friendly gods. Taking Bost to the Dallas Museum would have been like trying to get a bazooka through airport security. If not totally impossible, then at least pretty darn slow and difficult. Besides, Bost was our last line of defense for Brooklyn House. We needed her to protect our home base and our initiates. Twice before, our enemies had almost destroyed the mansion. We didn't want there to be a third time. Bost's bodysuit turned pure black, as it tended to do when she was moody.
"Still, I'd never forgive myself if you..."
She glanced at our tired, frightened crew.
"Well, at least you're back safe. What's the next step?"
Walt stumbled. Alyssa and Felix caught him. "I'm fine," he insisted, though he clearly wasn't. "Carter, I can get everyone together if you want. A meeting on the terrace?" He looked like he was about to pass out. Walt would never admit it, but our main healer, Jazz, had told me that his level of pain was almost unbearable all the time now. He was only able to stay on his feet because she kept tattooing pain relief hieroglyphs on his chest and giving him potions. In spite of that, I'd asked him to come to Dallas with us, another decision that weighed on my heart. The rest of our crew needed sleep, too. Felix's eyes were puffy from crying. Alyssa looked like she was going into shock. If we met now, I wouldn't know what to say. I had no plan. I couldn't stand in front of the whole gnome without breaking down. Not after having caused so many deaths in Dallas. I glanced at Sadie. We came to a silent agreement. "We'll meet tomorrow," I told the others. "You guys get some sleep. What happened with the Texans?" My voice caught. "Look, I know how you feel. I feel the same way, but it wasn't your fault." I'm not sure they bought it. Felix wiped a tear from his cheek. Alyssa put her arm around him and led him toward the stairwell. Walt gave Sadie a glance I couldn't interpret, maybe wistfulness or regret, then followed Alyssa downstairs. Hufu patted the golden cabinet. "Yeah," I said. "Could you take it to the library?" That was the most secure room in the mansion. I didn't want to take any chances after all we'd sacrificed to save the box. Hufu waddled away with it. Freak was so tired he didn't even make it to his covered roost. He just curled up where he was and started snoring, still attached to the boat. Traveling through the Duat takes a lot out of him. I undid his harness and scratched his feathery head. "Thanks, buddy. Dream of big fat turkeys." He cooed in his sleep. I turned to Sadie and Bost. "We need to talk." It was almost midnight, but the great room was still buzzing with activity. Julian, Paul, and a few of the other guys were crashed on the couches watching the sports channel. The ankle biters, our three youngest trainees, were coloring pictures on the floor. Chip bags and soda cans littered the coffee table. Shoes were tossed randomly across the snakeskin rug. In the middle of the room, The two-story-tall statue of Thoth, the ibis-headed god of knowledge, loomed over our initiates with his scroll and quill. Somebody had put one of Amos's old pork pie hats on the statue's head, so he looked like a bookie taking bets on the football game. One of the ankle biters had colored the god's obsidian toes pink and purple with crayons. We're big on respect here at Brooklyn House. As Sadie and I came down the stairs, the guys on the couch got to their feet.
"How did it go?" Julian asked.
"Walt just came through, but he wouldn't say..."
"Our team is safe," I said. "The 51st gnome? Not so lucky." Julian winced. He knew better than to ask for details in front of the little kids.
"Did you find anything helpful?"
"We're not sure yet," I admitted. I wanted to leave it at that, but our youngest ankle biter, Shelby, toddled over to show me her crayon masterpiece.
"I kill a snake," she announced. "Keel, keel, keel, bad snake."
She'd drawn a serpent with a bunch of knives sticking out of its back and X's in its eyes. If Shelby had made that picture at school, it probably would have earned her a trip to the guidance counselor. But here, even the littlest ones understood something serious was happening. She gave me a toothy grin, shaking her crayon like a spear. I stepped back. Shelby might have been a kindergartner, but she was already an excellent magician. Her crayons sometimes morphed into weapons, and the things she drew tended to peel off the page, like the red, white, and blue unicorn she had summoned for the 4th of July.
"Awesome picture, Shelby."
I felt like my heart was being wrapped tight in mummy linen. Like all the littlest kids, Shelby was here with her parents' consent. The parents understood that the fate of the world was at stake. They knew Brooklyn House was the best and safest place for Shelby to master her powers. Still, what kind of childhood was this for her? Channeling magic that would destroy most adults, learning about monsters that would give anybody nightmares. Julian ruffled Shelby's hair.
"Come on, sweetie. Draw me another picture, okay?"
Shelby said,
"Kill?"
Julian steered her away. Sadie, Bost, and I headed to the library. The heavy oaken doors opened to a staircase that descended into a huge, cylindrical room like a well. Painted on the domed ceiling was Nut, the sky goddess, with silver constellations glittering on her dark blue body. The floor was a mosaic of her husband, Jeb, the earth god, his body covered with rivers, hills, and deserts. Even though it was late, our self-appointed librarian, Cleo, still had her four Shabti statues at work. The clay men rushed around, dusting shelves, rearranging scrolls, and sorting books in the honeycombed compartments along the walls. Cleo herself sat at the work table, jotting notes on a papyrus scroll while she talked to Hufu, who squatted on the table in front of her, patting our new antique cabinet and grunting in baboon, like, "Hey, Cleo, want to buy a gold box?" Cleo wasn't much in the bravery department, but she had an incredible memory. She could speak six languages, including English, her native Portuguese, she was Brazilian, ancient Egyptian, and a few words of baboon. She'd taken it upon herself to create a master index to all our scrolls, and had been gathering more scrolls from all over the world to help us find information on Apophis. It was Cleo who'd found the connection between the serpent's recent attacks and the scrolls written by the legendary magician Setna. She was a great help, though sometimes she got exasperated when she had to make room in her library for our school texts, internet stations, large artifacts, and Boss's back issues of Cat Fancy magazine. When Cleo saw us coming down the stairs, she jumped to her feet.
"You're alive!"
"Don't sound so surprised," Sadie muttered. Cleo chewed her lip.
"Sorry, I just... I'm glad. Hufu came in alone, so I was worried. He was trying to tell me something about this gold box, but it's empty. Did you find the Book of Overcoming Apophis?
The scroll burned, I said. We couldn't save it. Cleo looked like she might scream.
But that was the last copy. How could Apophis destroy something so valuable?
I wanted to remind Cleo that Apophis was out to destroy the entire world, but I knew she didn't like to think about that. It made her sick from fear. Getting outraged about the scroll was more manageable for her. The idea that anybody could destroy a book of any kind made Cleo want to punch Apophis in the face. One of the Shabti jumped onto the table. He tried to stick a scanner label on the golden cabinet, but Cleo shooed the clay man away.
All of you, back to your places!
She clapped her hands, and the four Shabti returned to their pedestals. They reverted to solid clay, though one was still wearing rubber gloves and holding a feather duster, which looked a little odd. Cleo leaned in and studied the gold box.
There's nothing inside. Why did you bring it?
That's what Sadie, Bost, and I need to discuss, I said. If you don't mind, Cleo.
I don't mind.
Cleo kept examining the cabinet. Then she realized we were all staring at her.
Oh, you mean privately? Of course.
She looked a little upset about getting kicked out, but she took Hufu's hand.
Come on, Babuino Zinho. We'll get you a snack.
Ugh!
Hufu said happily. He adored Cleo, possibly because of her name. For reasons none of us quite understood, Hufu loved things that ended in O, like avocados, Oreos, and armadillos. Once Cleo and Hufu were gone, Sadie, Bost, and I gathered around our new acquisition. The cabinet was shaped like a miniature school locker. The exterior was gold, but it must have been a thin layer of foil covering wood because the whole thing wasn't very heavy. The sides and top were engraved with hieroglyphs and pictures of the pharaoh and his wife. The front was fitted with latched double doors, which opened to reveal, well, not much of anything. There was a tiny pedestal marked by gold footprints, as if an ancient Egyptian Barbie doll had once stood there. Sadie studied the hieroglyphs along the sides of the box.
It's all about Tut and his queen, wishing them a happy afterlife, blah, blah. There's a picture of him hunting ducks. Honestly, that was his idea of paradise?
I like ducks, Bost said.
I moved the little doors back and forth on their hinges. Somehow I don't think the ducks are important. Whatever was inside here, it's gone now. Maybe grave robbers took it, or Bost chuckled.
Grave robbers took it. Sure.
I frowned at her. What's so funny? She grinned at me, then Sadie, before apparently realizing we didn't get the joke.
Oh, I see. You actually don't know what this is. I suppose that makes sense. Not many have survived.
Not many what? I asked.
Shadow boxes.
Sadie wrinkled her nose.
Isn't that a sort of school project? Did one for English once. Deadly boring.
I wouldn't know about school projects, Bost said haughtily. That sounds suspiciously like work. But this is an actual shadow box, a box to hold a shadow.
Boss didn't sound like she was kidding, but it's hard to tell with cats.
It's in there right now, she insisted. Can't you see it? A little shadowy bit of Tut. Hello, Shadow Tut.
She wriggled her fingers at the empty box.
That's why I laughed when you said grave robbers might have stolen it. Ha! That would be a trick. I tried to wrap my mind around this idea, but I've heard Dad lecture on, like, every possible Egyptian artifact. I never once heard him mention a shadow box.
As I told you, Bast said, not many have survived. Usually the shadow box was buried far away from the rest of the soul. Tut was quite silly to have it placed in his tomb. Perhaps one of the priests put it there against his orders, out of spite.
I was totally lost now. To my surprise, Sadie was nodding enthusiastically.
That must have been what Anubis meant, she said. Pay attention to what's not there. When I looked into the Duat, I saw darkness inside the box, and Uncle Vinny said it was a clue to defeating Apophis.
I made a time-out tea with my hands. Back up, Sadie. Where did you see Anubis? And since when do we have an uncle named Vinny? She looked a little embarrassed, but she described her encounter with the face in the wall, then the visions she'd had of our mom and Isis and her godly almost-boyfriend Anubis. I knew my sister's attention wandered a lot, but even I was impressed by how many mystical side trips she'd managed just walking through a museum. The face in the wall could have been a trick, I said.
Possibly, but I don't think so. The face said we would need his help, and we had only 2 days until something happened to him. He told me this box would show us what we needed. Anubis hinted I was on the right track, saving this cabinet. And Mom...
Sadie faltered.
Mom said this was the only way we'd ever see her again. Something is happening to the spirits of the dead.
Suddenly I felt like I was back in the Duat, wrapped in freezing fog. I stared at the box, but I still didn't see anything.
How do shadows tie into Apophis and spirits of the dead?
I looked at Bast. She dug her fingernails into the table, using it like a scratching post, the way she does when she's tense. We go through a lot of tables.
Bast? Sadie asked gently. Apophis and shadows, Bast mused. I'd never considered.
She shook her head.
These are really questions you should ask Toth. He's much more knowledgeable than I.
A memory surfaced. My dad had given a lecture at a university somewhere. Munich, maybe? The students had asked him about the Egyptian concept of the soul, which had multiple parts, and my dad mentioned something about shadows. Like one hand with 5 fingers, he'd said. One soul with 5 parts. I held up my own fingers, trying to remember. 5 parts of the soul. What are they? Bast stayed silent. She looked pretty uncomfortable.
Carter?
Sadie asked.
What does that have to do?
Just humor me, I said. The first part is the ba, right? Our personality.
Chicken form, Sadie said.
Trust Sadie to nickname part of your soul after poultry. But I knew what she meant. The ba could leave the body when we dreamed, or it could come back to the earth as a ghost after we died. When it did, it appeared as a large glowing bird with a human head.
Yeah, I said, chicken form.
Then there's the ka, the life force that leaves the body when it dies. Then there's the ib, the heart.
The record of good and bad deeds, Sadie agreed. That's the bit they weigh on the scales of justice in the afterlife.
And fourth,
I hesitated.
The Wren, Sadie supplied, your secret name.
I was too embarrassed to look at her. Last spring, she'd saved my life by speaking my secret name, which had basically given her access to my most private thoughts and darkest emotions. Since then, she'd been pretty cool about it, but still, that's not the kind of leverage you want to give your little sister. The Wren was also the part of the soul that our friend Bess had given up for us in our gambling match 6 months ago with the moon god Hontz. Now Bess was a hollow shell of a god, sitting in a wheelchair in the underworld's divine nursing home. Right, I said. But the fifth part? I looked at Bost. It's the shadow, isn't it? Sadie frowned. The shadow? How can a shadow be part of your soul? It's just a silhouette, isn't it? A trick of the light. Bost held her hand over the table. Her fingers cast a vague shadow over the wood. You can never be free of your shadow. You should. All living beings have them. So do rocks, pencils, and shoes, Sadie said. Does that mean they have souls? You know better, Bost chided. Living beings are different from rocks. Well, most are, anyway. The shoot is not just a physical shadow. It's a magical projection, the silhouette of the soul. So this box, I said, when you say it holds King Tut's shadow, I mean, it holds one-fifth of his soul, Bost confirmed. It houses the pharaoh's shoot so it will not be lost in the afterlife. My brain felt like it was about to explode. I knew this stuff about shadows must be important, but I didn't see how. It was like I'd been handed a puzzle piece, but it was for the wrong puzzle. We'd failed to save the right piece, an irreplaceable scroll that might have helped us beat Apophis, and we'd failed to save an entire gnome full of friendly magicians. All we had to show from our trip was an empty cabinet decorated with pictures of ducks. I wanted to knock King Tut's shadow box across the room. Lost shadows, I muttered. This sounds like that Peter Pan story. Bost's eyes glowed like paper lanterns. What do you think inspired the story of Peter Pan's lost shadow? There have been folk tales about shadows for centuries, Carter. All handed down since the days of Egypt. But how does that help us? I demanded. The Book of Overcoming Apophis would have helped us. Now it's gone. Okay, I sounded angry. I was angry. Remembering my dad's lectures made me want to be a kid again, traveling the world with him. We'd been through some weird stuff together, but I'd always felt safe and protected. He'd always known what to do. Now all I had left from those days was my suitcase, gathering dust in my closet upstairs. It wasn't fair. But I knew what my dad would say about that.
Fair means everyone gets what they need, and the only way to get what you need is to make that happen yourself.
Great, Dad. I'm facing an impossible enemy, and what I need in order to defeat him just got destroyed. Sadie must have read my expression. Carter, we'll figure it out, she promised. Bost, you were about to say something earlier about Apophis and shadows.
No, I wasn't, Bost murmured.
Why are you so nervous about this? I asked. Do gods have shadows? Does Apophis? If so, how do they work?
Bost gouged some hieroglyphs in the table with her fingernails. I was pretty sure the message read, Danger.
Honestly, children, this is a question for Toth. Yes, gods have shadows. Of course we do. But it's not something we're supposed to talk about.
I'd rarely seen Bast look so agitated. I wasn't sure why. This was a goddess who'd fought Apophis face to face, claw to fang, in a magical prison for thousands of years. Why was she scared of shadows?
Bast, I said, if we can't figure out a better solution, we'll have to go with Plan B.
The goddess winced. Sadie stared dejectedly at the table. Plan B was something only Sadie, Bast, Walt, and I had discussed. Our other initiates didn't know about it. We hadn't even told our Uncle Amos. It was that scary.
I would hate that, Bast said. But, Carter, I really don't know the answers. And if you start asking about shadows, you'll be delving into very dangerous.
There was a knock on the library doors. Cleo and Hufu appeared at the top of the stairs.
Sorry to disturb, Cleo said. Carter, Hufu just came down from your room. He seems anxious to talk with you.
Ugh!
Hufu insisted. Bast translated from baboon speak.
He says there's a call for you on the scrying bowl, Carter. A private call.
As if I weren't stressed enough already. Only one person would be sending me a scrying vision, and if she was contacting me so late at night, it had to be bad news. Meeting adjourned, I told the others. See you in the morning. 4. I consult the pigeon of war. I was in love with a birdbath. Most guys checked their phone for texts, or obsessed over what girls were saying about them online. Me, I couldn't stay away from the scrying bowl. It was just a bronze saucer on a stone pedestal sitting on the balcony outside my bedroom. But whenever I was in my room, I found myself stealing glances at it, resisting the urge to rush outside and check for a glimpse of Zia. The weird thing was, I couldn't even call her my girlfriend. What do you call somebody when you fall in love with her replica Shabti, then rescue the real person only to find she doesn't share your feelings? And Sadie thinks her relationships are complicated. Over the past 6 months, since Zia had gone to help my uncle at the first gnome, the bowl had been our only contact. I'd spent so many hours staring into it, talking with Zia, I could hardly remember what she looked like without enchanted oil rippling across her face. By the time I reached the balcony, I was out of breath. From the surface of the oil, Zia stared up at me. Her arms were crossed, her eyes so angry they looked like they might ignite. The first scrying bowl Walt had made actually did ignite, but that's another story.
Carter, she said, I'm going to strangle you.
She was beautiful when she threatened to kill me. Over the summer, she'd let her hair grow out so that it swept over her shoulders in a glossy black wave. She wasn't the Shabti I'd first fallen for, but her face still had a sculpted beauty, delicate nose, full red lips, dazzling amber eyes. Her skin glowed like terracotta warm from the kiln.
You heard about Dallas, I guessed.
Zia, I'm sorry. Carter! Everyone has heard about Dallas. Other gnomes have been sending Amos bar messengers for the past hour, demanding answers. Magicians as far away as Cuba felt ripples in the duat. Some claimed you blew up half of Texas. Some said the entire 51st gnome was destroyed. Some said you were dead.
The concern in her voice lifted my spirits a little, but it also made me feel guiltier. I wanted to tell you in advance, I said, but by the time we realized Apophis's target was Dallas, we had to move immediately. I told her what had happened at the King Tut exhibit, including our mistakes and casualties. I tried to read Zia's expression, Even after so many months, it was hard to guess what she was thinking. Just seeing her tended to short-circuit my brain. Half the time, I could barely remember how to speak in complete sentences. Finally, she muttered something in Arabic, probably a curse.
"I'm glad you survived. But the 51st destroyed."
She shook her head in disbelief.
"I knew Anne Grissom. She taught me healing magic when I was young."
I remembered the pretty blonde lady who had played with the band and the ruined fiddle at the edge of the explosion. "They were good people," I said.
"Some of our lost allies," Zia said. "The rebels are already blaming you for their deaths. If any more gnomes desert Amos..."
She didn't have to finish that thought. Last spring, the worst villains in the House of Life had formed a hit squad to destroy Brooklyn House. We defeated them. Amos had even given them amnesty when he became the new chief lector. But some refused to follow him. The rebels were still out there, gathering strength, turning other magicians against us, as if we needed more enemies.
"They're blaming me?" I asked. "Did they contact you?" "Worse. They broadcasted a message to you."
The oil rippled. I saw a different face. Sarah Jacoby, leader of the rebels. She had milky skin, spiky black hair, and dark, permanently startled eyes lined with too much coal. In her pure white robes, she looked like a Halloween ghoul. She stood in a room lined with marble columns. Behind her glowered half a dozen magicians, Jacoby's elite killers. I recognized the blue robes and shaven head of Kwai, who'd been exiled from the North Korean gnome for murdering a fellow magician. Next to him stood Petrovich, a scar-faced Ukrainian who'd once worked as an assassin for our old enemy Vlad Menshikov. The others I couldn't identify, but I doubted that any of them was as bad as Sarah Jacoby herself. Until Menshikov had released her, she'd been exiled in Antarctica for causing an Indian Ocean tsunami that killed more than 250,000 people.
"Carter Kane!" she shouted.
Because this was a broadcast, I knew it was just a magical recording, but her voice made me jump.
"The House of Life demands your surrender," she said. "Your crimes are unforgivable. You must pay with your life."
My stomach barely had time to drop before a series of violent images flashed across the oil. I saw the Rosetta Stone exploding in the British Museum, the incident that had unleashed Set and killed my father last Christmas. How had Jacoby gotten a visual of that? I saw the fight at Brooklyn House last spring, when Sadie and I had arrived in Ra's sunboat to drive out Jacoby's hit squad. The images she showed made it look like we were the aggressors, a bunch of hooligans with godly powers beating up on poor Jacoby and her friends.
"You released Set and his brethren," Jacoby narrated. "You broke the most sacred rule of magic and cooperated with the gods. In doing so, you unbalanced Mart, causing the rise of Apophis."
"That's a lie," I said. "Apophis was rising anyway." Then I remembered I was yelling at a video. The scenes kept shifting. I saw a high-rise building on fire in the Shibuya district of Tokyo, headquarters of the 234th Gnome. A flying demon with the head of a samurai sword crashed through a window and carried off a screaming magician. I saw the home of the old chief lector, Michel Desjardins, a beautiful Paris townhouse on the Rue des Pyramides, now in ruins. The roof had collapsed, the windows were broken. Ripped scrolls and soggy books littered the dead garden, and the hieroglyph for chaos smoldered on the front door like a cattle brand.
"All this you have caused," Jacoby said. You have given the chief lector's mantle to a servant of evil. You have corrupted young magicians by teaching the path of the gods. You've weakened the House of Life and left us at the mercy of Apophis. We will not stand for this. Any who follow you will be punished.
The vision changed to Sphinx House in London, headquarters for the British gnome. Sadie and I had visited there over the summer and managed to make peace with them after hours of negotiations. I saw Kwai storming through the library, smashing statues of the gods and raking books off the shelves. A dozen British magicians stood in chains before their conqueror, Sarah Jacoby, who held a gleaming black knife. The leader of the gnome, a harmless old guy named Sir Leicester, was forced to his knees. Sarah Jacoby raised her knife, the blade fell, and the scene shifted. Jacoby's ghoulish face stared up at me from the surface of the oil. Her eyes were as dark as the sockets of a skull.
"The Canes are a plague," she said. "You must be destroyed. Surrender yourself and your family for execution. We will spare your other followers as long as they renounce the path of the gods. I do not seek the office of chief lector, but I must take it for the good of Egypt. When the Canes are dead, we will be strong and united again. We will undo the damage you've caused and send the gods and Apophis back to the Duat. Justice comes swiftly, Carter Kane. This will be your only warning."
Sarah Jacoby's image dissolved in the oil, and I was alone again with Zia's reflection.
"Yeah," I said shakily. "For a mass murderer, she's pretty convincing."
Zia nodded.
"Jacoby has already turned or defeated most of our allies in Europe and Asia. A lot of the recent attacks against Paris, Tokyo, Madrid, those were Jacoby's work. But she's blaming them on Apophis or Brooklyn House."
"That's ridiculous. You and I know that," she agreed.
"But the magicians are scared. Jacoby is telling them that if the Canes are destroyed, Apophis will go back to the Duat and things will return to normal. They want to believe it. She's telling them that following you is a death sentence. After the destruction of Dallas..."
"I get it," I snapped. It wasn't fair for me to get mad at Zia, but I felt so helpless. Everything we did seemed to turn out wrong. I imagined Apophis laughing in the underworld. Maybe that's why he hadn't attacked the House of Life in full force yet. He was having too much fun watching us tear each other apart.
"Why didn't Jacoby direct her message at Amos?" I asked. "He's the chief lector."
Zia glanced away as if checking on something. I couldn't see much of her surroundings, but she didn't seem to be in her dorm room at the First Gnome or in the Hall of Ages.
"Like Jacoby said, they consider Amos a servant of evil. They won't talk to him."
"Because he was possessed by Set," I guessed. "That wasn't his fault. He's been healed. He's fine." Zia winced.
"What?" I asked. "He is fine, isn't he?"
"Carter, it's complicated. Look, the main problem is Jacoby. She's taken over Menshikov's old base in St. Petersburg. It's almost as much of a fortress as the First Gnome. We don't know what she's up to or how many magicians she has. We don't know when she'll strike or where. But she's going to attack soon. Justice comes swiftly. This will be your only warning."
Something told me Jacoby wouldn't attack Brooklyn House again. Not after she'd been humiliated last time. But if she wanted to take over the House of Life and destroy the Kanes, what else could her target be? I locked eyes with Zia, and I realized what she was thinking. No, I said. They'd never attack the first gnome. That would be suicide. It survived for 5,000 years.
Carter, we are weaker than you realize.
We were never fully staffed. Now many of our best musicians have disappeared. Possibly gone over to the other side. We've got some old men and a few scared children left, plus Amos and me.
She spread her arms in exasperation. And half the time I'm stuck here.
Wait, I said. Where are you? Somewhere to Zia's left, a man's voice warbled.
Hello!
Zia sighed.
Great. He's up from his nap.
An old man stuck his face in the scrying bowl. He grinned, showing exactly 2 teeth. His bald, wrinkly head made him look like a geriatric baby.
Zebras are here!
He opened his mouth and tried to suck the oil out of the bowl, making the whole scene ripple.
My lord, no!
Zia pulled him back.
You can't drink the enchanted oil. We've talked about this. Here, have a cookie. Cookies! He squealed. Whee!
The old man danced off with a tasty treat in his hands. Zia's senile grandfather? Nope. That was Ra, god of the sun, first divine pharaoh of Egypt and arch-enemy of Apophis. Last spring, we'd gone on a quest to find him and revive him from his twilight sleep, trusting he would rise in all his glory and fight the chaos snake for us. Instead, Ra woke up senile and demented. He was excellent at gumming biscuits, drooling, and singing nonsense songs. Fighting Apophis? Not so much.
You're babysitting again? I asked.
Zia shrugged.
It's after sunrise here. Horus and Isis watch him most nights on the sunboat. But during the day, well, Ra gets upset if I don't come to visit, and none of the other gods want to watch him. Honestly, Carter.
She lowered her voice.
I'm afraid of what they'd do if I left Ra alone with them. They're getting tired of him. Whee!
Ra said in the background. My heart sank. Yet another thing to feel guilty about. I'd saddled Zia with nanny duty for a sun god. Stuck in the throne room of the gods every day, helping Amos run the first gnome every night, Zia barely had time to sleep, much less go on a date, even if I could get up the courage to ask her. Of course, that wouldn't matter if Apophis destroyed the world, or if Sarah Jacoby and her magical killers got to me. For a moment, I wondered if Jacoby was right. If the world had gone sideways because of the Kane family, and if it would be better off without us. I felt so helpless. I briefly considered calling on the power of Horus. I could have used some of the war god's courage and confidence, but I suspected that joining my thoughts with Horus's wouldn't be a good idea. My emotions were jumbled enough without another voice in my head egging me on.
I know that expression, Zia chided. You can't blame yourself, Carter. If it weren't for you and Sadie, Apophis would have already destroyed the world. There's still hope.
Plan B, I thought. Unless we could figure out this mystery about shadows and how they could be used to fight Apophis, we'd be stuck with Plan B, which meant certain death for Sadie and me, even if it worked. But I wasn't going to tell Zia that. She didn't need any more depressing news.
You're right, I said. We'll figure out something. I'll be back at the first gnome tonight. Call me then, okay? We should talk about...
Something rumbled behind her, like a stone slab grinding across the floor.
Sobek's here, she whispered. I hate that guy.
Talk later.
Wait, Zia, I said. Talk about what?
but the oil turned dark, and Zia was gone. I needed to sleep. Instead, I paced my room. The dorm rooms at Brooklyn House were amazing. Comfortable beds, HDTVs, high-speed wireless internet, and magically restocking mini-fridges. An army of enchanted brooms, mops, and dusters kept everything tidy. The closets were always full of clean, perfectly fitting clothes. Still, my room felt like a cage. Maybe that's because I had a baboon for a roommate. Hufu wasn't here much, usually downstairs with Cleo or letting the ankle biters groom his fur, but there was a baboon-shaped depression on his bed, a box of Cheerios on the nightstand, and a tire swing installed in the corner of the room. Sadie had done that last part as a joke, but Hufu loved it so much, I couldn't take it down. The thing was, I'd gotten used to his being around. Now that he spent most of his time with the kindergartners, I missed him. He'd grown on me in an endearing, annoying way, kind of like my sister. Yes, Sadie, you saw that one coming. Screensaver pictures floated across my laptop monitor. There was my dad at a dig site in Egypt, looking relaxed and in charge in his khaki fatigues, his sleeves rolled up on his dark, muscular arms as he showed off the broken stone head of some pharaoh's statue. Dad's bald scalp and goatee made him look slightly devilish when he smiled. Another picture showed Uncle Amos on stage at a jazz club, playing his saxophone. He wore round, dark glasses, a blue pork pie hat, and a matching silk suit, impeccably tailored, as always. His cornrows were braided with sapphires. I'd never actually seen Amos play on stage, but I liked this photo because he looked so energetic and happy, not like he did these days with the weight of leadership on his shoulders. Unfortunately, the photo also reminded me of Anne Grissom, the Texas magician with her fiddle, having so much fun earlier this evening, just before she died. The screensaver changed. I saw my mom bouncing me on her knee when I was a baby. I had this ridiculous fro back then, which Sadie always teases me about. In the photo, I'm wearing a blue onesie stained with pureed yams. I'm holding my mom's thumbs, looking startled as she bounces me up and down like I'm thinking, "Get me off of this ride!" My mom is as beautiful as always, even in an old t-shirt and jeans, her hair tied back in a bandana. She smiles down at me like I'm the most wonderful thing in her life. That photo hurt to look at, but I kept looking at it. I remembered what Sadie had told me, that something was affecting the spirits of the dead, and we might not see our mom again unless we figured it out. I took a deep breath. My dad, my uncle, my mom, all of them powerful magicians, all had sacrificed so much to restore the House of Life. They were older, wiser, and stronger than me. They'd had decades to practice magic. Sadie and I had had 9 months. Yet we needed to do something no magician had ever managed. Defeat Apophis himself. I went to my closet and took down my old traveling case. It was just a black leather carry-on bag, like a million others you might see in an airport. For years, I'd lugged it around the world as I traveled with my dad. He'd trained me to live with only the possessions I could carry. I opened the suitcase. It was empty now, except for one thing. A statuette of a coiled serpent carved in red granite, engraved with hieroglyphs. The name, Apophis, was crossed out and overwritten with powerful binding spells. But still, this statuette was the most dangerous object in the whole house, a representation of the enemy. Sadie, Walt, and I had made this thing in secret, over Bost's strong objections. We'd only trusted Walt because we needed his charm-making skills. Not even Amos would have approved such a dangerous experiment. One mistake, one miscast spell, and this statue could turn from a weapon against Apophis into a gateway allowing him free access to Brooklyn House. But we'd had to take the risk. Unless we found some other means of defeating the serpent, Sadie and I would have to use this statue for Plan B.
Foolish idea,
said a voice from the balcony. A pigeon was perched on the railing. There was something very un-pigeon-like about its stare. It looked fearless, almost dangerous, and I recognized that voice, which was more manly and warlike than you'd normally expect from a member of the dove family.
Horace?
I asked. The pigeon bobbed its head.
May I come in?
I knew he wasn't just asking out of courtesy. The house was heavily enchanted to keep out unwanted pests like rodents, termites, and Egyptian gods. I give you permission to enter, I said formally. Horace, in the form of a pigeon.
Thank you.
The pigeon hopped off the railing and waddled inside.
Why?
I asked. Horace ruffled his feathers.
Well, I looked for a falcon, but they're a little scarce in New York. I wanted something with wings, so a pigeon seemed the best choice. They've adapted well to cities, aren't scared of people. They're noble birds, don't you think?
Noble, I agreed. That's the first word that comes to mind when I think of pigeons.
Indeed, Horace said.
Apparently, sarcasm didn't exist in ancient Egypt, because Horace never seemed to get it. He fluttered onto my bed and pecked at a few Cheerios left over from Hufu's lunch.
Hey, I warned, if you poop on my blankets, please.
War gods do not poop on blankets. Well, except for that one time.
Forget I said anything. Horace hopped to the edge of my suitcase. He peered down at the statuette of Apophis.
Dangerous, he said. Much too dangerous, Carter.
I hadn't told him about Plan B, but I wasn't surprised that he knew. Horace and I had shared minds too many times. The better I got at channeling his powers, the better we understood each other. The downside of godly magic was that I couldn't always shut off that connection. It's our emergency backup, I said. We're trying to find another way.
By looking for that scroll, he recalled, the last copy of which burned up tonight in Dallas.
I resisted the urge to spike the pigeon. Yes, but Sadie found this shadow box. She thinks it's some sort of clue. You wouldn't know anything about using shadows against Apophis, would you? The pigeon turned its head sideways.
Not really. My understanding of magic is fairly straightforward. Hit enemies with a sword until they're dead. If they rise again, hit them again. Repeat as necessary. It worked against Set.
After how many years of fighting? The pigeon glared at me.
What's your point?
I decided to avoid an argument. Horace was a war god. He loved to fight, but it had taken him years to defeat Set, the god of evil. And Set was small stuff next to Apophis, the primordial force of chaos. Whacking Apophis with a sword wasn't going to work. I thought about something Bost had said earlier in the library. Would Toth know more about shadows? I asked.
Probably, Horace grumbled. Toth isn't good for much except studying his musty old scrolls.
He regarded the serpent figurine.
Funny, I just remembered something. Back in the old days, the Egyptians used the same word for statue and shadow, because they're both smaller copies of an object. They were both called a shut.
What are you trying to tell me? The pigeon ruffled its feathers.
Nothing. It just occurred to me, looking at that statue while you were talking about shadows.
An icy feeling spread between my shoulder blades. Shadows. Statues. Last spring, Sadie and I had watched as the old chief lector Desjardins cast an execration spell on Apophis. Even against minor demons, execration spells were dangerous. You're supposed to destroy a small statue of the target, and in doing so, utterly destroy the target itself, erasing it from the world. Make a mistake, and things start exploding, including the magician who cast it. Down in the underworld, Desjardins had used a makeshift figurine against Apophis. The chief lector had died casting the execration, and had only managed to push Apophis a little deeper into the Duat. Sadie and I hoped that with a more powerful magic statue, both of us working together might be able to execrate Apophis completely, or at least throw him so deep into the Duat that he'd never return. That was Plan B. But we knew such a powerful spell would tap so much energy, it would cost us our lives. Unless we found another way. Statues as shadows. Shadows as statues. Plan C began forming in my mind. An idea so crazy, I didn't want to put it into words. Horus, I said carefully. Does Apophis have a shadow? The pigeon blinked its red eyes. What a question! Why would you... He glanced down at the red statue.
Oh. Oh. That's clever, actually. Certifiably insane, but clever. You think Setna's version of the Book of Overcoming Apophis, the one Apophis was so anxious to destroy, you think it contained a secret spell for...
I don't know, I said. It's worth asking Toth. Maybe he knows something.
Maybe, Horus said grudgingly. But I still think a frontal assault is the way to go.
Of course you do. The pigeon bobbed its head.
We are strong enough, you and I. We should combine forces, Carter. Let me share your form as I once did. We could lead the armies of gods and men and defeat the serpent. Together, we'll rule the world.
The idea might have been more tempting if I hadn't been looking at a plump bird with Cheerio dust on its plumage. Letting the pigeon rule the world sounded like a bad idea.
I'll get back to you on that, I said. First, I should talk to Toth.
Bah! Horus flapped his wings. He's still in Memphis at that ridiculous sports stadium of his. But if you plan on seeing him, I wouldn't wait too long.
Why not?
That's what I came to tell you, Horus said. Matters are getting complicated among the gods. Apophis is dividing us, attacking us one by one, just as he's doing with you magicians. Toth was the first to suffer.
Suffer? How? The pigeon puffed up. A wisp of smoke curled from its beak.
Oh, dear. My host is self-destructing. It can't hold my spirit for much longer. Just hurry, Carter. I'm having trouble keeping the gods together, and that old man Ra isn't helping our morale. If you and I don't lead our armies soon, we may not have any armies left to lead.
But the pigeon hiccuped another wisp of smoke.
Gotta go. Good luck.
Horus flew out the window, leaving me alone with the statuette of Apophis and a few gray feathers. I slept like a mummy. That was the good part. The bad part was that Bast let me sleep until the afternoon.
Why didn't you wake me up? I demanded. I've got things to do.
Bast spread her hands.
Sadie insisted. You had a rough night last night. She said you needed your rest. Besides, I'm a cat. I respect the sanctity of sleep.
I was still mad, but part of me knew Sadie was right. I'd expended a lot of magical energy the previous night and had gone to sleep really late. Maybe, just maybe, Sadie had my best interests at heart. I just caught her making faces at me, so maybe not. I showered and dressed. By the time the other kids got back from school, I was feeling almost human again. Yes, I said school, as in normal old school. We'd spent last spring tutoring all the initiates at Brooklyn House, but with the start of the fall semester, Bost had decided that the kids could use a dose of regular mortal life. Now they went to a nearby academy in Brooklyn during the day and learned magic in the afternoons and on weekends. I was the only one